Now, you mentioned the flip of the annex paper and the paper on arms sales. What are the kinds of things that you work on? Other kinds of long papers or short papers? Anything that sticks out in your memory? Some of the research papers that you put together during this period?
Well, we did some papers in INR on arms transfers that were fascinating. We studied how arms that were purchased for one country would end up being transshipped to other places and end up in totally different countries. And that was a lot of fun, sort of tracing how arms moved internationally and through some Inter-Armco and various dealers that worked. Samuel Cummings down here in Alexandria, who runs it's changed his name since then, but it's still one of the major arms sales companies in the world. Mm-hmm. And there's so many other companies and ways in which arms move, and we traced a lot of this. It was sort of a regional policy more than an Iran-centered issue. It was about how arms moved through that whole area of the country. On Iran, I did a lot of analysis of political developments as they came along, but nothing really stands out that much in my mind at this point.
Mm-hmm. Now, during this period, the Shah made a few visits to Washington. I think it was 167, I think 168, maybe others, I don't recall. Did INR analysis play any role in the preparation of material for these visits, background material, or whatever? Was that more or less for the country desk to do?
It was more for the country desk to do, but occasionally we'd have some input. And on one occasion, some material that I wrote was included sort of at the last minute by Bill Miller, who at that time was working in the Secretariat. And he managed to get some of his material into one of the briefing books. I think, as I recall, the situation had been refused earlier and then eventually got into the book. But, it was pretty small stuff, because briefing books are probably never read in toto anyway. People don't have time. They need the book as a reference in case some issue comes up that they're not fully up to speed on. They can quickly turn to a certain page and get the facts. But INR's role was very minor in any of this preparation.
Now, during most of these visits, the Shah came with requests for more Ex-Im Bank credits to finance arm purchases. Did you at INR play any kind of role in evaluating these requests? Were there meetings to discuss whether the U.S. should provide more money or not?
No.
And what the pros and cons were?
No.
That was not in your...
No, that wasn't. Yeah. That was an operational issue that was totally in the hands of the country director.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. But these country team meetings, was it discussed in the country team meetings?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I would not have felt free to comment on the specific issue of how to structure the loan or whatever. This was an operational issue that I was able to hear by being at the meetings, but it wasn't one I was expected to comment on.
Was there much agreement or disagreement over these requests at these meetings? Was there much controversy? Were they just pretty much passed on routinely?
There was quite a sense that the groundwork had been carefully laid in advance. Well, not just the embassy, but by the country director, that he had worked things out with the appropriate people in the other places in Washington that were involved, like Ex-Im or Treasury or whatever, Commerce, that the bases had all been touched, and the meeting was more or less to tell the rest of the group how things were going to be done. And there would be occasional disagreements on this or that. There were certainly disagreements when we had these annual reviews. There'd be differences between the various agencies as to how much they thought the Shah could afford to spend on this or that. But on practical issues like the terms for some loan, whatever, there was really very little discussion at these meetings.
In terms of the differences between agencies on the larger questions, like how much the Shah could afford to spend, my impression is the Defense Department was somewhat more critical of larger credits for arms purchases, and the state was somewhat more lenient. Is that correct?
Well, I think so, because the Defense Department people would analyze strictly in terms of what they thought the Shah needed, and some of his requests they thought were overblown and grandiose and, you know, unnecessary and so on. We would tend to be on the other side because we would want to meet the Shah's demands to the extent we felt we could based on other agencies' possible disagreement here in Washington. And then you had other influences. I mean, I think Treasury was genuinely concerned about the sense of priorities in Iran and how much they could afford given the debts that they had. You know, this was still before the big oil revenue period. I mean, oil revenues were coming in, but they were, it was one of many factors. The price of oil was still fairly low at that point, so, you know, there was a lot of question as to whether the Shah's priorities were right, and a lot of people felt that he should spend more on road building, airports, all kinds of infrastructure questions were being given inappropriate or insufficient attention while he was running off planning all these great things to buy on toys that could be paraded on Armed Forces Day and Azerbaijan Day and so on. So there was a lot of that feeling that I think drove other people's questions about whether they should have all they wanted.
Another area of contention, I think, was between the U.S. and the Shah, and this previous, was the Shah was trying to get this was a question of petroleum production and prices. Like the consortium that ran the oil industry in Iran was trying to more or less hold that production to get stable prices and profits. Whereas the Shah was trying to get them to increase their production so he could get more revenues to finance his various weapons purchases and so forth. Did you do any position any papers on this, any research on this aspect of oil price production issues in the 60s?
No.
That was probably in the energy section, I guess, right?
Yes, to the extent it was done. The energy office was very small at that point, and just really getting organized in the mid-60s. I went to that office later in the end of 69, worked on energy issues for the next 2.5 years, and that was a time when we're having a lot of influence under Jim Akins, who was the very active director at that time.
Did you make any trips to Iran while you were at the INR? Did you go back and visit at any point? Or?
Never. In fact, this is one of the advantages, you know, that under the system of having someone who'd been in the country, is that you didn't have to go back out there to have a quick familiarization trip and then come back and be able to write effectively about the country. You already had that experience, and you could just keep up with, you know, on the basis of what you knew with all the new facts coming across your desk and not need to make a trip.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, in late 67, the British made their announcement that they would, by the end of 71 or so, withdraw their military presence from the Persian Gulf. In this decision, late 67, early 68, did this prompt any discussion at INR about the implications for the U.S. and Iran?
Oh, yes, sure.
Do you recall any issues that were discussed, or what kind of implications were drawn out? Did you do reports on it?
Well, sure, there was a lot of analysis about what would happen in this situation, and with the British plan to withdraw, and with everyone assuming that the United States could not afford to really do everything the British had been doing out there, there was a lot more intention to beef up the power of people in the area to make them able to provide the stability that was needed. Cento was still a factor at that time. It was considered to be important. RCD, so-called Regional Cooperation for Development, by Turkey, Iran, and Pakistan, that was getting a lot of attention in the individual countries. So there was a great feeling that our policy was finally paying off. After all the years of supporting the Shah, he was coming to a point where he could provide a certain amount of stability in the area for the era when the British were going to withdraw, that one of our policies in the whole area had been to encourage countries to be able to run their own affairs. And you, I don't remember exactly when it, when that was taking place, but the whole development of the United Arab Emirates, you know, these seven sheikhs getting together and forming the UAE, that was a major development, which came later, but that another example of the idea of people in the local area having to take more responsibility for their action.
So this, this idea of having the Iranians play a sort of stabilizing role in the region once the, as the British leave, this was sort of being discussed before Nixon's president. This is called the Nixon Doctrine.
Yeah.
This is already being discussed before he's...
Well, I would say yes, right. As I mean, this was sort of, you know, our, we'd always said that CENTO was a defensive arc that, that we supported. Of course, first the Baghdad Pact, and then Iraq was, the Iraqi government overthrown, so it became later CENTO, and CENTO, of course, over the years became somewhat less effective. Is more difficult to get the countries to agree on issues, and the idea of the U.S. backing it was becoming a little less popular, but still, CENTO and RCD, these two institutions, were developing more self-sufficiency on the part of the countries in that area. So this was a thought that when the British left, maybe they would be able to take on more responsibilities there.
Were there any people arguing that the U.S. should take, play a larger role to replace the British? Were there any people taking that point of view? Was that sort of just discussed and dismissed?
Well, it's hard to recall exactly, but my impression is that people felt we'd be hard-pressed to do everything the British had been doing out there, given all of our other responsibilities in the Pacific and... So, I mean, you know,
Vietnam War is going on.
Right.
Now, when did you, at what point did you stop working on Iran during the late 60s?
In 1968, mid 68, because then I went to an economic course over at the Foreign Service Institute, which lasted 22 weeks. Was equivalent academically to a minor in economics at a university. Intensive, all day long course work for 22 weeks with a tremendous reading list and a big shelf of books to read, and you know, quite a rigorous course. And then after that, I went into this Office of Fuels and Energy for 2.5 years and worked in a very interesting period, because that was all the time when OPEC was feeling its power, and which I think ironically has been laid at the door of fuels and energy, and even at the door of Jim Akin, as if, you know, saying that the State Department showed OPEC how it could use its power by predicting that they were going to have this kind of influence. And I think it's totally misplaced, because OPEC was already beginning to feel its power. It had been founded in 1961, I think, and you know, at first it had almost no power, but gradually they were getting people who were trained in the States and had come back to work for OPEC. They were learning more, and they were gradually understanding the kind of power that they had, and they were beginning to exercise it. And all we did in the Office of Fuels and Energy was to more or less tell everyone who should be listening that OPEC had some power, and that we should start to adjust to this and learn how to cope with it. And because we were taking that position, it was in some quarters considered that we were in effect telling OPEC how to exercise its power. And I think it's totally wrong, because they had no need of us telling them. And they, in fact, we were beginning to be whipsawed between two areas. We had the first price breakthroughs, where they were increased, came in Libya.
Yeah, right.
And then,
late 70s, I think.
And then as soon as those were accepted, then the Shah and the others in the Middle East would demand a similar increase, and then Libby would ask for more, and then the other would ask for more, and it just came ratcheting upward in an alarming fashion, and they obviously felt very quickly that they had a lot of power.
So the work you do at the bureau touch upon the U.S. and Iran, or was it other countries, or
it touched on Iran, but I was not working on Iran per se. In fact, I was working more on European issues in that office. Jim Akins had been in Baghdad. Was very well checked out on Middle Eastern issues, so he more or less ran some of these particular issues himself, because he, as head of the office, he felt he had to be, you know, in the forefront of this whole new development. And there were a lot of tremendous issues, including antitrust issues, you know, the question of how, to what degree could American firms work together to negotiate vis-a-vis OPEC countries.
Because
there had been, in the past, there had been this injunction against any kind of effort by the oil companies together to set prices, and yet here we were in a situation where OPEC was rapidly becoming unified and demanding these price increases, and they were playing the companies off one against the other. If you don't increase the amount of money we get from your oil, we're going to stop taking from you and take from this other firm. And you know, it was essential to get the oil companies together to try to resist this tremendous upward movement on the prices.
But that didn't happen, though, did it? They didn't really.
Well, there was a lot of they did give them waivers to get together and prepare uniform positions that could be presented to OPEC countries. I think without that, the price would even gone further, because there was the OPEC people were very adept at playing one supplier against another. Yeah. And Occidental was often, you see, the maverick in Libya.
Yeah.
I mean, Armin Hammer was known as an individualist who would do things his way, and when he felt it was necessary to give a bigger take to the host government, he did so, and then right away everybody else was put in a position having to match that. So, in that area, and then they whipsawed us over into the Middle East, where those producers demanded the same thing as the North Africans got, with appropriate adjustments for the different types of oil. Yeah. It's a very complicated issue, but
To what extent were the oil companies really try to forge a united front vis-a-vis the whole of OPEC? I mean, did they try that for a while? What was proposing? And then the idea was sort of the idea of having an entire united front of all the companies vis-a-vis all of OPEC. Wasn't that sort of dropped? I haven't thought about this for a while, so I might be...
I think it was...
Wrong about the details or the facts.
I think there was a feeling that companies had to get together to at least exchange a lot of information so that they would all be aware of the latest developments, because if that antitrust rule was taken literally, then the companies could not get together to discuss any kind of issues together.
Yeah.
So they had to at least get together to exchange information and know how everybody else was going to be impacted by this. But they couldn't present a totally united front because they all had
sectoral differences,
and some were more into refining, some were more into production, and some were in both, and some were looking for crude to buy, others had crude from their own resources in tremendous amounts, and they were looking for markets. So there was a limit on how much they could coordinate exactly their policies, but they certainly had to be allowed to get together to present united fronts in some of these specific negotiations, where certain groups would be invited in to talk to, like the consortium members in Iran. You know, they formed a group that had to be allowed to meet together, because if not, there would be no way they could negotiate against the Shah, because the Shah had all the resources of OPEC and NIOC and so on at his beck and call, and he would come forth with these tremendous demands, you know, and the consortium would be hard pressed to. To come up with its position to answer all these, because no sooner would they start to meet some demands part way than the Shah would make a whole new series of demands, and it was a very exciting time.
Yeah. So So you were working on that through 71, I guess?
Mm-hmm.
And you went to Wisconsin from there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for a one-year research and writing fellowship.
That wasn't at the land?
Well, I went to something called the Center for Development,
okay,
which was a Rockefeller program that brought middle-level officials from various governments to University of Wisconsin for a sort of undergraduate to graduate level academic exposure along with a number of American students. So, you know, we had people from India, Sri Lanka, Cyprus, a lot of developing countries, and then American students as well, and all together in the Center for Development. Mm-hmm. But then while I was at Wisconsin, I audited some courses at the Land Tenure Center and used their library, and because I was very interested in that subject, and that's what I eventually wrote a paper on as a result of that, about the economic and political imperatives of land reform.
And what was your next diplomatic assignment?
Then I went to India,
yeah,
for 2 years. 72 to 74.
You work on economic issues there, or a political officer again? Or?
At the beginning, I was executive assistant to the ambassador, and before I ever got there, the ambassador that I was supposed to go to work for resigned his post. Senator Keating, who's ambassador, and he resigned and went back to the States, and then we had a chargé d'affaires. I worked for him, and then I worked at the beginning for Moynihan when he came out as ambassador. And then I felt that I really did not want to stay in this particular kind of front office work, because it was very, very tiring and very demanding, tremendous number of hours spent. And so I moved into the political section and completed the rest of my tour there, working in the political section as number two to the political counselor.
What kind of issue did you work on in the political section?
Well, a great variety of issues, really, because we were a fairly small political section and yet had this tremendous country to cover, so there was more than any one person or even any five people could report on, so we were always trying to cover the most important things that were going on, external as well as internal, so it was a mixed menu of activities.
Okay. And what brought you back to Iran?
Well, they needed somebody in the embassy to be the number two man in the political section again, because they had someone assigned out there who did not know Farsi, and they felt that they should have a Farsi speaker available. Mm-hmm. There was also another person in the political section who had Farsi training, but the fact that I had been there earlier gave me a certain amount of perspective on the changes that had occurred in the country, and so that was felt to be desirable. I had mixed feelings about going back to Iran. I mean, on one hand, it was interesting to see it 8 years later, you know, and to again return to some of the same contacts that I had before, so on. But in other ways, it was a disappointment, because the country had become so much more frenetic in its pace in the intervening years. I thought of it as a sort of a Klondike mentality. Everybody was out to get as much money as they could, and you know, there was very little of the old Persian give and take and talk and, you know, meditation and so on. It was just, everything was, as I say, a frenetic pace, and the traffic was just impossible. The pollution was awful. So a lot of things that I'd recalled from before had deteriorated. The quality of life had deteriorated considerably.
To what extent did you kept in touch with the situation, with the developments of the country, since you had left INR?
I kept fairly well aware of everything going on because, of course, Foreign Service tends to share its reporting quite widely, and any kind of a wider analytical piece, like an analytical aerogram covering a large issue, will be sent to a number of posts that may be interested in that same issue. Or so, in India, I would see a great deal of the reporting on Iran, not sort of operational traffic as to who was coming out to visit and all that sort of thing, but anything that was more regional in scope or larger in its analytical ambit would be sent to the embassy in the mm-hmm. New Delhi for information. Mm-hmm. Because, for one thing, the Indians were showing a lot more interest in regional issues, and there were visits back and forth by the Indian president to Iran and the Shah to India, and there were Indians being sent by the thousands, sent or drawn by the sent by the Indian government as some technical assistance people, or drawn by the economic prosperity of the Persian Gulf area to serve in private positions there. There were thousands of Indians and Pakistanis all over the Gulf area who were out there to really sort of seek their fortunes. Because at home, India was just, filled with well-qualified people, and they just couldn't all find gainful employment unless they had some government angle or whatever. So a lot of them ended up going overseas or with the UN or with private entities or whatever to find jobs where there was money. So there was a lot of contact back and forth between the Persian Gulf area and India in those days, and a lot of issues that we analyzed sort of in regional terms for Iran would be shared with India and vice versa.
What was your appraisal of the policy approach that Nixon and Kissinger had taken since, I guess, early 69? The policy approach to the Shah and Iran generally? By the time you arrived, say?
Well, I felt that it was true that the Shah had begun to show quite a geopolitical sense in how he approached things in our area. He, as you may recall, he had sent troops into Oman to help the Sultan there put down a rebel group that was supported by communist-influenced Yemen. South Yemen, People's Democratic Republic of Yemen. And if you read a lot of his policy pronouncements, the Shah was quite far thinking about his general attitude toward the whole Persian Gulf and the Indian Ocean, and he had a lot of good ideas. So I agreed with the Nixon doctrine. I thought we were, well advised to foster independence and stability in these countries so that they could run that area's affairs in a reasonable way. And the Shah was concerned about communism. He was aware of the Soviet threat. But where I felt uncomfortable was the degree to which we just embraced the Shah. I mean, it was so total that it always gave me a queasy feeling, when I heard him being extolled as the democratic leader and the far-sighted man who's done such a tremendous revolutionary job in Iran and meeting his people's needs, as if the White Revolution, which I generally admired and supported, had all been accomplished. It was as if the whole thing had been done, and therefore we could bask in the reflected glory that this man we'd supported all these years had finally accomplished all these wonderful revolutionary goals that he set out to do. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's why I wrote one of the pieces I did here, this Airgram 31 here in February 75, the Shah People Revolution. I tried to analyze the development of the 12-point plan from the very beginning, and I had trouble selling my thesis about this historical development, which was that the National Front was the first group that really talked about an effective land reform program. And in fact, I believe I'm correct that they even had something similar to the Literacy Corps in mind in some of their pronouncements. I mean, there were some very forward-thinking people in the National Front. When I tried to sell that in the embassy, I had some reluctance on the part of Jack Miklos, who felt that the National Front had never accomplished anything, and they were just a bunch of people out of power who wanted to grab power, and you know, this never were a serious alternative to the Shah. My position, as I stated in this aerogram, was that the Shah had cleverly seen the appeal that some of these National Front policies that they advocated had, and had simply absorbed those policies in his own way and formed his own policy of the White Revolution, which he started in a small way with just a few reforms, and then, as we saw, it expanded to finally be a 12-point program. I thought he'd cleverly used some of these, and yet my conclusion here was that as important as the reforms were, and as laudatory as many of them were, they've by no means been accomplished, and some of them were just being ballyhooed to the point where, you know, they were acts of faith, as if they'd...
Or public relations type thing.
They were more PR than they were actual accomplishment. Yeah. Now, I had documented in my village studies that I did back in the 60s, I documented the improvement of living conditions in villages under land reform. And I continued to take that position here, that land reform had basically been a benefit, and that Literacy Corps, Health Corps, some of these had, Houses of Justice had really been important steps ahead, but that a lot of other things were just pretty much window dressing and really had not accomplished a great deal. And that to speak of them as if they were all fait accompli was really selling a bill of goods, and convincing ourselves that the Shah had done more than he really had done. And I was amazed when Carter came into office and visited Tehran and made a similar effusive comment about the Shah, this wonderful person who accomplished so much for his people and brought democracy to. I mean, it was such an overaction and a fulsome embrace that I just felt terribly uncomfortable with it. And I just felt that we should have been able to accept the Shah for what he was, a complex person with a lot of good intentions, but also a lot of failings and a very poor sense of how to organize his own country. I always said he was a much better geopolitician than he was a political leader of his own country, because he was never really at home with his own people. I don't think he went to school in Switzerland, and he had this world vision all the time. He was constantly talking about world issues and large developments in the world. When it got down to his own country, he oftentimes showed that he just didn't really know how to proceed, even such things as the resurgence party, which he decreed when he saw that the Iran Noveen party, which had a little bit of independence and had attracted some people who, although they knew it was sanctioned by him, they still felt that there were some independent points of view could be pushed as members of the Iran Noveen party. Even that was considered to be a little too risque, so he wanted this resurgence party, which was going to include practically the whole country, and it was just a terrible idea. I mean, you know, you either were in it and it meant nothing, or you were out and it could mean that you'd even be forced to leave the country. So practically everybody joined it, and what did that mean? You know, it's so inclusive, it didn't really have any importance to it. It was just a sort of a union card to get any kind of a job, to just be a member of the party.
So stay out of trouble, huh?
Stay out of trouble, and it meant nothing to join it because you had to join it, effectively. So, you know, the claims of membership and so on were just unimportant because with no alternative, everybody just joined it and continued to, you know, talk against the Shah and so on as they had before. So it really was a silly activity, and yet it took a tremendous amount of organizational ability and a lot of money to organize great congresses and meetings and hoorahs.
Do you have a sense of what it might have been counterproductive politically in some ways? But I guess the Rasakis led a lot of to control prices in the bazaar and so forth.
Yes, there was a whole anti-corruption issue which focused on the bazaar, and they had these teams going around singling out people who had overcharged and bringing action against them and closing their shops. I mean, it was all a big ploy because Iranians would tell me that, you know, here the Shah's coming down hard on a few bazaar merchants for overcharging, and yet his twin sister Ashraf is making millions every year from all her contacts. She controlled the trucking industry, and she had all kind of, her husband controlled all the hotel reservations for any meeting that took place in Iran. Bushari, he controlled the travel agency that made all the arrangements for these groups to visit. So every time there was any kind of international meeting in the country, they'd fly on Iran Air or some other airline, and then they would stay in either Pahlavi Foundation hotels or other hotels, all arranged by this man, Bushari. And Ashraf is getting this tremendous rake off in the trucking industry every year because everybody in the whole country who's in the trucking industry had to, you know, fork over part of their money to her. I mean, it was just, there was such corruption by the family that every time anything came up, whether it was an airport construction or a road building project, a chemical plant, anything, everyone always tried to find out who it was in the royal family who was benefiting. There was always a prince or a princess or somebody who was getting a piece of the action. Because that's how you got approval for things. You managed to get someone with the right connections in the group that was sponsoring the project, and then it would get the royal assent, and you could go ahead with it. If you didn't, it was very hard to get things approved. So there was so much corruption of that type, and yet they were singling out a few poor bazaar merchants for overcharging for a pair of shoes or length of pipe.
Well, by the way, when did you arrive in Iran? Was it when in 74 did you settle in Tehran?
It would be about June or July.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Around this time, Richard Helms was ambassador to the country. What was your appraisal of Helms as ambassador?
He was a really brilliant guy with a lot of energy. He really was indefatigable in his activities in Iran. He was always interested in what was going on, always willing to see people, going on trips all over the place. He just had a very inquiring mind, and he just could never get enough information. He read widely, talked to a lot of people. He and his wife both were very interested in everything Iranian and made an awful lot of trips around. She's written about it in a book, as you know. Very fair with people. I remember one incident particularly where I had proposed that we start a refugee program to allow some of the Kurdish refugees to come to the States. This was after we pulled the plug on our aid, and then the Shah pulled the plug on his aid at almost the same time, so the poor Kurds were pushed up against the border by the Iraqis, and they fled by the tens of thousands into Iran and were put into camps, tent tent camps, which I visited a few times, and I felt that we at least had some moral responsibility for this situation, and that we ought to be willing to take some of these refugees to the state. I proposed this, and Jack Miklos was, I think, clearly against the idea, and I kept arguing my point, and then finally he said, well, let's take it to the ambassador, and we went to Helms and discussed it briefly, and he said, well, all they can do is say no. We can propose it. If they say no, that's the end of it. If they accept it, then fine. So the proposal went in, and it was accepted, and I worked with the consular section and with a UN official sent out for the purpose, and we coordinated the whole effort with the Iranians, and eventually about 450 Kurdish refugees left the country and came to the United States.
Mm-hmm. How did Helms run the embassy as compared to, say, Holmes or Palmyra?
I think he ran it more like Holmes did, in the sense that he wanted information to percolate up from the bottom. He wanted people to do analytical pieces. He wanted all that to go on, and he would, you know, read things, and if he had problems, he would suggest changes. But he was really quite democratic in that. He wanted people to have their own say. He didn't dictate how certain issues were going to be handled. So I would say it was a very good embassy. I mean, he clearly had priorities on what he wanted covered, but as long as everybody was covering all the bases, he felt that they should develop the material from the bottom. Of course, he did send in his own cables on audiences with the Shah and things like that, which had become, that was standard in Holmes too. I mean, because after all, the only person who can report on it is the man who was there. But I think he was an excellent ambassador. I really do. And he certainly was not resting on his laurels, in the sense of, you know, a person of his accomplishments could have just sort of coasted along and enjoyed a comfortable life in a nice embassy residence there and just done sort of licking and polish. But he worked hard, and you know, he did have a policy of leaving fairly early in the evening, which I thought was great. You know, I mean, he was so efficient that he had his work all carefully spread out during the day, and I forget when it was he left, but usually by 5:30 or something, he'd be out of his, or maybe 6, he'd be out of his office. You know, he just insisted that people bring things to him early in the day, and he wasn't one to keep everybody late, you know, while he worked on this or that detail or whatever. I think he was very fair with the staff. I do feel that there was one area where he was a little deficient, and that is the area of the contacts, because, as I mentioned earlier, I felt that the same kind of contacts that were carried on in my earlier time could have been reinstituted when I was there. I did reinstitute some, but I felt very uneasy about it. And when I proposed that we reestablish some contact with clerical people like Kotsi, the attitude was, well, let's think about that, and it was never done.
I think this is Helms' response, that he would consider it. But
yeah. But within that limitation, I still felt that he was extremely open to ideas and did not have at all a closed mind on what was going to be reported to Washington. He was willing to let everybody have their say, and so I was very impressed with his activities as ambassador.
I think we're running out of paper now.